Chapter 6, Acceptance and Rejection. According to the most ancient Buddhist traditions, there were three levels of monkhood. There was the Shramanera, or novice monk, the Bhikshu, or full monk, and the Stavira, or elder monk. The novice monk observed 10 precepts and could be ordained by a single elder monk, provided the consent of the other monks had been obtained. The Bhikshu, or full monk, observed, according to the Theravada, 227 precepts, 75 of which were really rules of etiquette, and 7 rules of procedure to be observed by the Bhikshus collectively, and could be ordained outside the middle country by a minimum of 5 full monks in good standing, among whom there was at least one elder monk to act as president. The elder monk was simply one who had been a full monk for at least 10 years, or rather one who had observed at least 10 reigns residences. Ordination as a novice monk was often known in English as the lower ordination, and ordination as a full monk as the higher ordination. There was no special ceremony for the elder monk. On completing his 10th reigns residence, the full monk automatically became entitled, provided he was otherwise qualified, to preside at bhikshu ordinations and to accept junior monks as personal disciples. I was, of course, a novice monk, and more than a year and a half had passed since my ordination at Kusinara. In the Theravada countries of Southeast Asia, as I well knew, only a short time usually elapsed before the novice monk became a full monk. Indeed, if he was over 20, age being reckoned from conception, not birth, the likelihood was that the higher ordination would follow immediately upon the lower, often as part of one and the same ceremony. Had I become a Shramanera in Ceylon or Burma instead of in India, there was little doubt that I would have been a bhikshu by now. I certainly wanted to be a bhikshu. Exactly when the idea had first taken root in my mind, I could not say. Probably it was quite soon after I became a Shramanera, perhaps as soon as I grasped what being a bhikshu, as distinct from being a Shramanera, really meant. Since that brilliantly sunny day in March when Kashyapji had enjoined me to stay in Kalimpong and work for the good of Buddhism, especially since the YMBA had come into existence, the idea of being a bhikshu had taken firmer root than ever. Indeed, it had flowered into a definite wish for the higher ordination. Though a Shramanera had gone forth from home into the homeless life, he had not won acceptance, as the word Upasampada, signifying bhikshu ordination, was sometimes translated, and was not, therefore, really a member of the monastic order. In a sense, he was neither monk nor layman. He dwelt in a kind of intermediate state between two worlds, the spiritual and the secular, at best occupying a place on the fringes of monasticism. For me, this was no longer enough. I wanted to be a real monk, not a hanger-on of the monastic order. I wanted to identify myself with Buddhism and the spiritual life as fully as I possibly could, and to know that the fact that I had so identified myself was acknowledged by other Buddhists. This meant, in effect, receiving the higher ordination, meant becoming a bhikshu, a full monk. As a full monk, I would not only be able to commit myself more firmly to the goal of enlightenment, but also to work more effectively for the good of Buddhism. 18 months after my ordination as a novice monk, so much at least was clear to me. But where could I be ordained? Who would be willing to admit me to the monastic order? There were no Theravada monks in Kalimpong, and I did not know enough about Tibetan Buddhism to be able to think of asking for the higher ordination in that quarter. A few weeks after my visit to Darjeeling, when I was still deeply immersed in English and logic, there came a letter that seemed to point a way out of the difficulty. The letter was from Venerable M. Sangaratana Thera, the secretary of the Sarnath Centre of the Mahabodhi Society, and was an invitation to the 19th anniversary celebration of the opening of the Mula Gandakuti Vihara. The Mula Gandakuti, or, quote, original perfumed chamber Vihara, so named after the room or hut occupied by the Buddha, especially the one made for him by Anatta Pindika, was the temple that Anagarika Dhammapala, the founder of the Mahabodhi Society, had built on the site of the deer park where the Buddha had delivered his first discourse. And I knew that the anniversary of its opening was celebrated each year by hundreds or even thousands of people from all over the Buddhist world. Among these people, there would surely be many bhikshus, some of whom might be willing to make up the quorum of 10 bhikshus needed to confer higher ordination in the Middle Country. I therefore wrote to Venerable Sangharatana, accepting his invitation, and to Yu Chandramani, formally requesting the higher ordination, as I knew that in most years the old man came down to Sarnath for the anniversary celebration. I also took the precaution of writing to Yu Kittima, Yu Chandramani's senior-most disciple, who was in charge of the Burmese temple in Sarnath, asking him to intercede with Babaji, as our teacher was affectionately called, on my behalf. The letters having been sent, there was nothing more I could do except hope that by the time I reached Sarnath, arrangements for my higher ordination would have been made. I did not have to leave at once. This was fortunate, as it meant I could keep the tutorial classes going right up to the eve of the examinations, as well as to bring out the November issue of Stepping Stones and make arrangements for the running of the YMBA during my absence. It also meant that for a few more weeks I could enjoy the perfect autumn weather, which brought not only continual sunshine and an abundance of flowers, but the daily unveiling of the sublime spectacle of Mount Kanchenjunga. Whenever I looked out of my window, I could see afar off the dazzling white mass of the great snow range rising from behind its saddleback against a backdrop of dark blue sky, the topmost peak wearing a plume of white smoke. As I knew by this time, the name Kanchenjunga meant the five treasures of the snow. The five treasures being gold, silver, gems or weapons, grain and sacred books. According to local belief, the mountain was the abode of many gods, was itself a god. To set human foot upon it would be an act of sacrilege, and it had therefore never been climbed by anyone. With autumn had come the pujas, the great series of Hindu religious festivals that celebrated, among other things, the victory of the hero Rama over the ten-headed tyrant Ravana, and of the goddess Durga over the ferocious buffalo demon. Celebrated, that is to say, the victory of the forces of good over the forces of evil. Like the Christmas season in the West, the pujas were a time of general rejoicing, of family reunions, of giving and receiving presents and blessings, as well as being, of course, a time of eating, drinking and making merry. Like Christmas too, the pujas were a time for worship. In their case, the colourful and sanguinary ritual worship of the great Mother Goddess in her various forms, both benign and terrible. In a small, out-of-the-way place like Kalimpong, where there was in any case a substantial Buddhist minority, the pujas naturally were not celebrated on anything like the scale on which they were celebrated in Calcutta and Kathmandu, or even in Darjeeling. Certain minor festivals were in fact omitted. Nevertheless, even in Kalimpong, despite their comparatively modest scale, the pujas could not be ignored. From a loudspeaker in the heart of the bazaar, there floated up the lilting melody of the latest popular film song. That year, I think it was Tu Pyara Ke Sagra Ho, or You Are the Ocean of Love, a song that in the film itself was addressed to Sri Krishna, but which was generally given a wider and more romantic application. Along the main road, below the vihara, and through the streets of the town. There strolled bands of happy, carefree people, the majority of them Nepalese. Most of the people were dressed in new clothes, with many of the men and boys wearing garlands of marigolds round their necks and red tikka marks on their foreheads. Occasionally, a cow or a dog with a garland of marigolds and a red tikka mark could also be seen. The cow wore its garland and tikka mark with dignity, the dog with a raffish air. I myself took no part in the puja celebrations, being well content to observe them from a respectful distance. I did, however, buy myself a bright red woolen shawl. This was on account of the season, not in the socio-religious, but in the meteorological sense, for despite brilliant sunshine and blue skies, autumn could be quite cold in the hills, cold enough to make me shiver in my two thin cotton robes. The shawl was of the cheapest kind, costing me only 12 rupees, and I bought it at the Himalayan store. 12 rupees being quite a large sum to me then, before making the purchase, I debated the pros and cons of the matter anxiously with myself for several days. Did I really need the shawl? What was the justification of spending so much money merely for the sake of comfort? Was it, in fact, merely for the sake of comfort? Ought I to run the risk of catching a chill and thus possibly endangering my health? In the end, prudence prevailed over asceticism, and I bought the shawl. The bright red colour was the same as that of the poinsettias, or Christmas red, as the shrub was called in Kalimpong, great clumps of which were already lifting their scarlet crowns beside the road. Walking through the bazaar, I was conscious of being a more conspicuous figure than ever. Though I myself was content to observe the pujas from a respectful distance, my students certainly were not. Most of them were eager to participate in the celebrations as fully as their preoccupation with the forthcoming examinations allowed. For some of the more important festivals, Sachin, Lachiman and Padam, even appeared in traditional Nepalese costume, seemingly no less self-conscious in their pastel green and pastel blue shirts and jodhpurs, and their conical embroidered hats, than I was in my bright red shawl. Eager as they were to participate in the pujas, however, the students did not trouble their heads very much about their religious significance. So far as they were concerned, the significance of the various festivals was social and cultural rather than religious. They knew what good Hindus were supposed to do when the pujas came round, but had no idea why they were supposed to do it. This was particularly the case with a festival or observance that came towards the end of the puja season, which, thanks to the students themselves, became a means of raising funds for the YMBA. The festival in question was known as Dasara. Why it was celebrated and what the name itself meant, no one in Kalimpong seemed to know. Some thought the words Dasara were a corruption of Deva Sri Rama, but even this was not certain. All that was certain was that Dasara was celebrated and that it was celebrated in a particular way. Parties of young men and boys went from door to door singing songs and collecting money. Originally, the money thus collected was devoted to religious and charitable purposes, but in recent times, things had changed, at least in Kalimpong. Dasara parties now tended to be made up of very small boys who were simply out to collect sweet money for themselves. For this reason, people no longer took Dasara seriously and gave the boys hardly any money when they called, just a few annas for old time's sake. Some of the students thought it a great pity that Dasara had degenerated in this way, and that money was no longer being collected for religious and charitable purposes. Perhaps the ancient practice could be revived. Why should we not have a YMBA Dasara party, and why should it not go from door to door collecting funds for YMBA activities? Whether the idea came from me or from the students themselves, I no longer recollect. It may simply have crystallised out of the air in the course of discussion without being attributable to anybody in particular. At any rate, no sooner was the idea of our sending out our own YMBA Dasarae party put forward than it met with an enthusiastic response, and Sachin undertook the responsibility of forming the party and organising rehearsals. On the 10th and 11th of November, therefore, under Sachin's leadership, some 15 members of the YMBA made the rounds of the town and the development area, calling at the houses of a number of our friends and sympathisers. Most of these friends and sympathisers were Nepalese Hindus of various castes and tribes, but there were also a few Tibetan Buddhists among them, as well as a few Europeans. Everywhere it went, the party received a warm welcome. Nepalese Hindus in particular were overjoyed that the ancient practice had been revived and that Dasarae was again being celebrated in a befitting manner. When a few songs had been sung, the women of the house would smilingly come forward with the traditional ceremonial offering of a tray full of rice on which were flowers and sometimes a lighted oil lamp. Among the flowers would be tucked a currency note. At some houses, especially those, not a few, where Sachin was personally known, the party would be invited in for refreshments or laughingly requested to sing another song. All 15 students thoroughly enjoyed collecting funds in this way. Accompanied by a small double-headed drum, they sang not only various popular songs, but the customary Dasarae song. The latter was a vigorous, not very tuneful chant in which the soloist's appeals for money alternated with a full-throated chorus of Dasarae from the rest of the party. From time to time, the appeals for money were replaced by nonsense words and phrases, which allowed the introduction of an element of buffoonery that set the women tittering. By the time Dasarae was over, Sachin and the rest were all suffering from sore throats, but nearly 200 rupees had been collected, and everybody is well pleased. Our friends and sympathisers were pleased to have had an opportunity of showing their appreciation of what the YMBA was doing, especially in the way of providing tutorial classes for students. Our members were pleased to have been able to do something for the YMBA themselves, and thus to help me help them. As usual, the only person who was not pleased was Great Wisdom. Since Nucha's argument with him, he had had less to do with me than ever. In fact, even when I was in the library looking at the Buddhist magazines and he was sitting at his little table behind the door, he did his best to pretend that I was not there, that I did not exist. This did not, of course, prevent him from abusing the YMBA behind my back as much as ever, or from continuing to send false reports of what was happening at the Vihara to his former disciples in Nepal. For a long time, these reports had met, as it seemed, with no better success than they deserved. No one heeded his call to come and help him drive the low-caste intruders from the bazaar out of the Vihara before they destroyed it completely. Probably the monks of Nepal were observing the rain's residence. Possibly they were all asleep. Recently, however, there had been a change. Things were at last beginning to move in the direction the ex-monk wanted. Though not pleased with the success of our Dasarae party, he was therefore not quite so displeased with things in general as he had been, and even permitted himself a triumphant smirk. My first intimation that there was anything wrong came quite unexpectedly. Either shortly before or shortly after the idea of our sending out our own Dasarae party had been put forward, probably before, one of the students, a Nepalese Brahmin, on happening to look out of the window, suddenly exclaimed, "How can such an angry-looking man be a Buddhist monk?" Several of the other students rushed to the window, while I turned my head round to look. Sure enough, stomping up the path below was a man in yellowish-brown robes and with an expression of habitual ill-temper on his face. Great Wisdom's call for help had been answered. The reinforcements had at last arrived. The Venerable Aniruddha, as the angry-looking monk was called, was in his mid-30s and was, of course, by origin a Nyuwa Buddhist. After being ordained a novice monk by Yu Chandramani, he had gone to Burma for a few years and there received the higher ordination. With his angry look, rough speech and uncouth ways, he was, in fact, much more like some of the Burmese monks I had seen than their Newar counterparts. Burmese members of the monastic order being a byword for irascibility. The Venerable Aniruddha, indeed, could be said to exemplify, in many points, Buddha Ghosha's classic description of the person of angry temperament. Such a person digs his toes into the ground when walking, is of rigid demeanour, performs any action in a rough and violent manner, eats his food hastily and without pleasure, and, if he is a monk, wears his robes tightly fastened and awry. All this and more was true of the Venerable Aniruddha. When we met, his first act was to thrust into my hand a letter from the secretary of the Dharmodiya Sabha, Venerable Mahanama, informing me that the bearer had been appointed as monk in charge of the Vihara, and that I should carry out whatever instructions he gave me. This, of course, was only right and proper. The new arrival was a full monk, almost an elder. I was only a novice monk. It was for him to guide me, not for me to guide him. By both actions and words, Venerable Aniruddha spoke a little Hindi. I therefore sought to convey to him that in my eyes he was not just the monk in charge of the Vihara, but my own immediate monastic superior, and that, as directed by Venerable Mahanama, I was ready to carry out all his instructions. For the moment, however, Venerable Aniruddha had no instructions to give. The truth of the matter was, he had arrived fully prepared to do battle on Great Wisdom's behalf, and the discovery that the Vihara was not being torn down over the ex-monk's head and not being used for parties and dances had rather disconcerted him. He therefore contented himself with scowling at any student he came across and shouting threateningly to nobody in particular, "This place is a Vihara, you know," and "Some people don't know how to show proper respect to a bhikshu." Showing proper respect meant making the traditional prostrations. Most of the students did not think it necessary to take Venerable Aniruddha very seriously, and I did not feel justified in disillusioning them. Some of them even thought him a little crazed. Before the week was out, we had grown more or less accustomed to his irate presence about the place, and were no longer perturbed by the violent quarrels he was having with Great Wisdom, mostly about money. By the time this happened, I was already preparing to leave for Saranath. With the start of the examinations, the tutorial classes had come to an end. The November issue of Stepping Stones was out, and I was free to go. Swale agreed to collect the mail from the post office each day while I was away and deal with urgent letters, while Sachin undertook to see to the running of the recreation hut. As for Joe, he had already left for Lucknow after promising to meet me in Saranath. Since the day of his arrival, he had been utterly fascinated by the fantastic sights and exotic inhabitants of Kalimpong, as he put it. And despite his initial disappointment with the YMBA, he had now decided to settle in the little Himalayan township for good. He had also formed a strong attachment to an 18-year-old Nepalese artist, a worker in the Kalimpong arts and crafts, whose talents, in Joe's opinion, were being wasted on lampshades and fire screens. And this fact, too, may have had something to do with his decision. Before he could settle in Kalimpong, however, Joe had to wind up his affairs in Lucknow, and this, he thought, would take him 3 or 4 weeks. While there, he would try to arrange a few lectures for me, and I could accompany him back to Lucknow after we had attended the Mulagandakuti Vihara opening anniversary celebrations. Though, in fact, free to leave Kalimpong somewhat earlier, it was not until the third week of November that I set out on my journey. Nearly 10 months had passed since my coming up into the hills with Kashyap G, and during that time I had almost forgotten what life in the plains was like. Going from Kalimpong down to Siliguri, which was the nearest railhead, was like entering into another world. It was a world of oppressive heat, of all-pervading dust, and of well-nigh universal poverty. It was also a world of politics, Though Kalimpong was no Shangri-La, during my stay there, very little outside news had reached me, most of it relating to Tibet, where the Chinese communist troops were steadily advancing on Lhasa, or to Nepal, where an armed uprising against the autocratic Rana regime had broken out. In the plains, one could not get away from politics. 3 years after independence, there was still considerable tension between India and Pakistan, particularly over the link line that connected Assam with the rest of India. Between Siliguri and Calcutta, this line ran not only through West Bengal, which was part of India, but also through East Bengal, which was part of Pakistan. When a train halted at stations in West Bengal, Muslim passengers were liable to be attacked by local Hindus. And when it halted at stations in East Bengal, Hindu passengers were likely to be attacked by local Muslims. Of late, the number of such incidents had increased and there had been several deaths. The government of India was therefore thinking of closing the line. Knowing nothing of this, I bought an intermediate class ticket for the overnight train. There were very few passengers on board, but though this was highly unusual in India, I did not give the matter much thought. In the middle of the night, the train stopped at the Pakistan border. Hindu passengers were made to alight, and their luggage was thoroughly searched. Shortly afterwards, a Pakistani customs officer, obviously a Muslim, entered the compartment and asked me how much money I had on me in Indian currency. 80 rupees, I replied quite truthfully. He seemed rather taken aback by this information, but passed on without saying anything. Later, I learned that 50 rupees was the maximum amount of Indian currency one was permitted to import into Pakistan, and that to try to import more was a serious offence. At the Indian border, things were more relaxed. Indeed, as day dawned and as the train penetrated deeper into West Bengal, the compartment gradually filled up and a lighter atmosphere prevailed. I had once been told that all the most interesting people in India travelled by intermediate class. If one went first class, one met only members of the upper classes, princes, millionaires, ICS officers, and top military brass. If second class, only the members of the middle classes, doctors and lawyers, the moderately rich, and lower-ranking civil and military officers. And if third class, only members of the working classes, peasants, factory hands, domestic servants, and the hoi polloi generally. If one travelled intermediate, however, one met members of the relatively classless and casteless intelligentsia. One met the more cultured minority. To what extent this was true of the occupants of my own compartment, I could not say. With one exception, they consisted of English-educated Hindus, neither particularly old nor particularly young. The exception, a very striking one, was a tiny old man wearing a long black gown and big white turban. He was a Mulvi, or Muslim priest, and could hardly have been less than 80. Before long, most of the people in the compartment were engaged in conversation. Not unnaturally, their main topic was the tension between India and Pakistan and the continued violence on that particular section of the railway. Since much of the conversation was in Bengali, I could follow what was being said only in a general way, but a serious argument had, it seemed, developed between three or four of the educated Hindus and the old Mulvi, and they were pressing him pretty hard. Why, they wanted to know, was it necessary for the subcontinent to be divided? Why did the Muslims have to be so different from the Hindus? What was the reason for their intransigent attitude? To all these questions, the old man had only one answer. Khuda ka hukum hai. It is God's will, he exclaimed, laying tremendous stress on the word will and bringing his clenched fist down onto his knee with tremendous force to emphasise the point. Khuda ka hukum hai. so overcome was he by the sense of the divine omnipotence and its absolute overridingness in all human affairs, that he more than once shed tears. At length, one of the Hindus, perhaps growing impatient with all these references to the divine will, and not convinced that God was as responsible for everything as the Maulvi believed, demanded, "Why can't you Muslims live at peace with the Hindus?" The old man looked at him steadily for a minute. Then, in a quiet, dangerous voice, with the air of one producing a dagger, he slowly asked, "Have you heard the word achut?" "Achut means untouchable." "Of course I've heard it," replied the Hindu. "But what is that?" "Say no more," roared the old man, his eyes blazing and his whiskers bristling with indignation. "Say no more." There was indeed no more to say. That was the end of the argument and of our journey. Shortly afterwards, the line was closed. On my arrival at Sarnath, I had spent a night or two in Calcutta before continuing on my way. I lost no time in going to the Burmese temple and meeting U Kittima. The Burmese temple was situated about a quarter of a mile from the Mulagantakuti Vihara, on the opposite side of the archaeological area. It was a somewhat gloomy place, three or four solidly built but rather unsightly buildings, among them the temple proper, which contained the Sima, or ordination area, stood amidst big trees within a compound entirely surrounded by a crumbling stone wall. Access was by a sort of causeway across a moat filled not with water so much as with semi-liquid mud, on the surface of which was a dried-up layer of brilliant green scum. I had stayed at the Burmese temple once before on my return from Nepal and had already made U Kittima's acquaintance. He was a taciturn but not unfriendly man of about 50, more scholar than monk, who sat in a cane armchair, quietly puffing endless Burmese cheroots. Beside him was a big brass spittoon into which every now and then he spat. He had no disciples, his entire household consisting of a Brahmin woman who did the cooking and the woman's teenage son, who acted as a sort of manager. U Kittima was not above joking about his little menage, maintaining that the scriptures were full of references to Shramana Brahmana, that is, bhikshus and Brahmins, and that he was only being faithful to the ancient ideal. Faithful or not, his household had apparently expanded since my last visit. Washing clothes at the well and lounging beneath the trees were a number of people, most of them Burmese and most of them pilgrims. U Kittima himself was in the library. When I had paid my respects, he told me, in his usual unhurried way, that he had good news for me. Yes, U Chandramani had consented to my receiving the higher ordination and had directed him to make arrangements for the ceremony. Unfortunately, he added, Babaji himself would not be attending as he was ill in bed at Kusinara. But I was not to worry. Two distinguished elder monks were arriving from Rangoon, and one of them would act as preceptor and preside over the ceremony in Babaji's place. On the 24th of November 1950, being the full moon day at 9 o'clock in the morning, I therefore received the higher ordination in the Mahawijitawa Sima of the Arya Sangharama, as the Burmese temple was officially called. Four or five dozen people were present. Within the ordination area, which was marked off by means of a number of low posts of a special kind, were seated 14 full monks from Burma, Ceylon, Nepal, and India. I was seated in the midst of the monks, directly facing, for the greater part of the time, the Upadhyaya, or preceptor. Outside the ordination area, though still within the temple, sat the lay community, or more strictly speaking, all those who were not full monks, that is, who were either lay disciples or novice monks, or who were not full monks according to the Theravada tradition. The most important person inside the Sima was, of course, the preceptor, U Kawinda Sayadaw, the senior of the two elder monks who had come from Rangoon. He was a softly spoken, mild-mannered man of about 50, who, I afterwards learned, was a celebrated preacher. The most important person outside the Sima was Kusho Bakula, the well-known Ladakhi incarnate lama, an aloof, mysterious figure with a strangely triangular face and an expression of remarkable thoughtfulness and refinement. He was in Sarnath for the opening ceremony celebrations and had been invited to attend the ordination. Having been ordained according to the Tibetan Mahayana, properly Savastivada, tradition, it was not possible for him to be seated inside the Sima, it being considered important to keep different lines of monastic ordination distinct. Instead, he sat at the head of the lay community, immediately behind the other monks, and right up against the Sima. He thus occupied, in a sense, a position midway between the lay community and the monastic community, a position not inappropriate in the case of one who is a follower of the Bodhisattva ideal, of being, quote, in the world but not of it, and who was himself widely regarded as a veritable embodiment of that ideal. The actual ordination was a straightforward, almost business-like affair. Yu Kawinda, as Upadhyaya, put before the monks the notion that the novice monk Sangrachita wished to receive the high ordination from the assembly, with Venerable Kawinda as his preceptor, and that the assembly should, if it so wished, grant him the ordination. Three batches of three monks in turn then requested the assembly to agree to the motion that the novice monk Sangrachita be granted the higher ordination from the assembly, with Venerable Kawinda as his preceptor, each batch repeating the request in unison once. The assembly remaining silent, the motion was declared carried. I was now a bhikshu, a full monk, a member of the monastic order. Immediately before the ordination, that is, before the putting of the motion, I had been reordained as a shramanera and interrogated with regard to various disabilities. The first batch of monks reciting the request consisted of Yu Kawinda himself, Yetanapon Yu Sagaya, and Venerable Dhammarachita. Yu Sagaya was a thick-set, beetle-browed man of about 40, who was General Secretary of the Mahasanghas of Burma. Venerable Dhammarachita was an Indian disciple of Yu Chandramani, who had joined the Mahabodhi Society and was now editor of Dhammadut, the society's Hindi monthly. The second batch consisted entirely of Sinhalese monks. There was stout, amiable Sasanasiri, thin, voluble Sangharatana, and silent, smiling Sivali. All three belonged to the Sarnath Centre of the Mahabodhi Society, of which Venerable Sangharatana was, of course, secretary. The third batch consisted of monks of three different nationalities. Foremost among them was Kashyapji, who had come from Bihar Sharif for the occasion and who had acted as acharya, or teacher, at the ceremony, reordaining me as a shramanera and interrogating me with regard to the disabilities. With him were joined Sadatisa, a youngish Sinhalese monk who was studying for a degree at a local college, and Amritananda, a Nepalese Nyuwa monk, whom I had met in Rajgir the previous year. After the ordination, Yu Kawinda, who spoke little English, explained to me in a gentle, kindly manner what were known as the nisayas, or reliances, of the monk. He should rely on alms for food, on dust heap rags for robes, on the roots of trees for lodging, and on cow's urine for medicine. Nonetheless, allowances were made. A monk could also accept invitations to meals, wear robes made of various materials, live in a house or cave, and take ghee, butter, oil, honey, and sugar when sick. Since much of the ordination was conducted in Burmese Pali, that is, in Pali chanted in the guttural Burmese fashion with many mispronunciations, for example, Tissa for Tassa and Gissami for Gachami, I was unable to follow it very well. Only some time later, when I had studied the relevant texts and reconstructed the ceremony stage by stage, did I really understand what had happened. At the time, however, my inability to follow the ordination procedure did not bother me very much. Whilst the ceremony was in progress, I experienced an extraordinary sense of peace, satisfaction, fulfilment and acceptance and belonging. It was a feeling such as I had not experienced before, and in the subsequent years, I was never surprised when an elderly monk told me that receiving the monastic ordination had been the greatest experience of his whole life. The day following the ordination, I left for Lucknow. Joe, who had been present at the ceremony, was anxious that we should be off. Before our departure, Hugh Kawinda took me aside. Since I would not be staying with him, he explained, it would be necessary for me formally to renounce my nisaya, or reliance, on him. Generally, a monk stayed with his preceptor for 10 years, or at least for 5. Renouncing my nisaya meant I was effectively on my own. Hugh Kawinda also gave me his card, gilt-edged and bright pink in colour. If ever I visited Burma, he smilingly assured me, I could stay with him at his monastery for as long as I liked. So far as ancient monuments were concerned, Lucknow was a Muslim rather than a Hindu city. Joe lost no time in taking me on a rapid tour of the principal buildings of interest, among which were the 18th century Imambara, or mausoleum, one of the largest ruins in the world, and the great Jama Masjid, or Friday Mosque. For the better part of the day, we traversed vast empty courtyards, climbed enormous flights of stairs, and gazed up at floating domes and soaring minarets. Once again, I admired, as I had admired in Delhi 6 years earlier, the grandeur, simplicity, and refinement of the Mughal style of architecture, where red sandstone and white marble meet in perfect harmony, and where, quote, all below is strength and all above is grace. Most of my time during the 4 days I spent in Lucknow was devoted not to seeing buildings, however, but to meeting members of the city's tiny Buddhist community, as well as Hindu intellectuals sympathetic to Buddhism. Joe had arranged for me to stay at the Bodhisattva Vihara, which belonged to the Lucknow branch of the Bengal Buddhist Association, of which he was still president. This made it possible for me to see the local Bengali Buddhists. Many of whom came to take the refuges and precepts from me each morning and to make the usual ceremonial food offering. He had also arranged for me to visit the Buddhist temple, as the Mahabodhi Society's Lucknow Centre was called. Had he not done this, it might have been thought that I was being deliberately kept away from the place. Conflict between the two viharas was fortunately a thing of the past, but a certain amount of rivalry persisted, and it was necessary to avoid misunderstandings. At the Buddhist temple, where there was a more cosmopolitan atmosphere than at the Bodhisattva Vihara, I met people from a number of different communities. Among them was the Venerable Pranyananda, the friendly, English-educated young Sinhalese monk, who, on the death of Bodhananda Mahastavira, had succeeded to the incumbency of the Vihara. His main interest, he told me, was publishing Buddhist literature in English and Hindi. Besides meeting people individually and discussing Buddhism with them, while in Lucknow I gave 3 lectures. Mindful of the promise he had given before leaving Kalimpong, Joe had arranged for me to give 2 lectures at the Bodhisattva Vihara and 1 at Lucknow University. The lecture I gave at the university was the means of bringing me into contact with 2 outstanding scholars, one of whom was then at the beginning of his career and the other very near its close. It also marked the beginning of my doubts concerning the general intellectual level among university students. The scholar who was at the beginning of his career was Dr. Herbert Vinje Jantike Günther. Austrian by birth and about 30 years of age, he had left Europe for personal reasons a year or two earlier and was now a lecturer in the university's Department of Philosophy. Joe was on friendly terms with him and his Austrian-born wife, Sarojini, and in Kalimpong I had heard much from him about them. Dr. Günther was undoubtedly a man of great intellectual brilliance. He had read an extraordinary number of Buddhist texts in the original Pali and Sanskrit, and could quote from them to illustrate a point or reinforce an argument with astonishing readiness and fluency. Before leaving Europe, he had published a book in German on The Soul Problem in Ancient Buddhism, a book which I believe he afterwards repudiated. His current love was the Vajrayana, about which he held forth at great length and with tremendous enthusiasm and wonderful eloquence, so much so, indeed, that I invited him to contribute articles on the subject to Stepping Stones. As well as being a man of great intellectual brilliance, Dr. Günther was a man of great intellectual arrogance. I soon found that it was not possible in his presence to mention the name of any other scholar working in the field of Buddhist studies, however eminent, without his instantly pouring forth the vials of his wrath upon the unfortunate man's head. Professor X, he didn't know a word of Sanskrit. He hadn't read a single text in the original language. Dr. Y, a complete ignoramus, had got absolutely nothing right. And so on. His strongest expressions of contempt were reserved for a very distinguished historian of Indian philosophy, risen to high office in the state, who, according to Dr. Günther, had not personally examined a single Sanskrit manuscript and was forced to rely entirely on English translations. The man was, in fact, nothing but an out-and-out charlatan, not a scholar at all, but a politician. Sweeping denunciations of this kind disfigured Dr. Günther's conversation in much the same way that they afterwards disfigured some of his books, and I found his hypercritical stance not very much to my liking. Joe, I could see, felt differently. Arms clasped round his knees, blue eyes gleaming, he leaned forward eagerly, drinking in every intemperate word. It was clear that he liked hearing clever people being given, as he thought, their comeuppance, and that he saw Günther as a sort of hero, slaying the intellectual dragons, in a way he would have liked to do himself had he been able. The only living scholar for whom Dr. Günther appeared to have any regard at all was Dr. Surendranath Dasgupta, who was the other outstanding scholar with whom I came into contact in Lucknow. If anything, he seemed to have too high a regard for him, as though he was compensating for his underestimation of all other scholars by overestimating this one. According to Günther, the account of Buddhist philosophy contained in the first volume of Dr. Dasgupta's standard work, A History of Indian Philosophy, was not only thoroughly reliable, but the only reliable one available in English at all. With this I strongly disagreed. To me it seemed that Dasgupta's discussion of the Madhyamika school was quite inadequate, and that he had not only relied for his understanding of the awakening of faith on an English translation, an unforgivable sin in Günther's eyes, but had uncritically accepted this well-known text as a Chinese translation of an original Indian work. In comparison with the magnitude of his total achievement, however, these were minor blemishes, and there was no doubt that with the possible exception of one or two Indian scholars of the old type, he was supreme in his field. There's also no doubt that he was approaching the end of his career. He had returned to India from Cambridge a very sick man, and not knowing how much time he had left, was now hard at work on the fifth and final volume of his history. In this, he had the collaboration of his wife, Surama, a scholar in Indian philosophy in her own right, who was a former student of his and considerably younger than he was. Though they must have been busy, both husband and wife received me with great kindness, and Das Gupta and I had a long discussion on Buddhism. Despite the fact that he was a Hindu by birth, his attitude towards Buddhism was both sympathetic and fair-minded, and I found him more willing to recognize the extent to which Buddhism had influenced Hinduism than Hindu scholars usually were. When I asked him if he agreed with Swami Nikhilananda, the translator of the Mandukya Karikas, that their author Gaudapada was neither a Buddhist nor influenced by Buddhism, he shook his head. Regardless of whether or not Gaudapada was a Buddhist, the influence of Buddhism on his thinking could not be denied. The great Shankara himself, grand disciple of Gaudapada and the brightest ornament of the Advaita Vedanta school, was influenced by Buddhism. The concept of samsara as beginningless, which Shankara had adopted, was of Buddhist origin. Buddhism had profoundly influenced popular Hinduism too. Saraswati, the goddess of learning, for instance, was first mentioned in a Mahayana Buddhist sutra, in which she undertook to help the Buddhist monks not to forget the scriptures which they had committed to memory. In this way, 2 or 3 hours passed very agreeably. While we were talking, Surama, who had joined in the discussion from time to time, brought us tea. She also showed me the 2 thick manuscript volumes of her PhD thesis on, quote, the concept of karma in Indian thought, in which the Hindu, Buddhist, and Jaina philosophies of karma were examined in considerable detail. Though Das Gupta and I found ourselves in agreement on most topics, the venerable old scholar was plainly worried by what he considered my excessively dynamic interpretation of Buddhist philosophy and spiritual life. Unfortunately, the word dynamic was my own. I had been trying to explain the nature of praticca samutpada, or conditioned co-production, as an all-embracing reality that included both the cyclical process of mundane existence and the spiral process of spiritual life and growth, and in this connection had described Buddhism as seeing reality in dynamic rather than in static terms, and as being therefore a dynamic religion. "Oh no," the old man protested with something like a shudder, "Buddhism was not dynamic at all. Spiritual life was not dynamic. Spiritual life was peace. It was rest. Profound rest." Evidently, after his 5 years in Europe, the connotation of the term dynamic was, for Dr. Das Gupta, anything but positive. Dynamic to him suggested restlessness, assertiveness, ambition. And dynamic Buddhism, a religion that was either the oriental counterpart of muscular Christianity or else aggressively missionary in character. This was not at all what I had meant to convey, but seeing the look of sadness and suffering in the dark eyes and the expression of profound weariness on the deeply furrowed face, I did not pursue the matter further. Besides, even when dissenting from what he understood me to have said, the saintly old scholar expressed himself with such childlike simplicity and gentleness, and with such an entire absence of arrogance, that I did not think there was any real need for me to clear up the misunderstanding and justify my use of the word. Great scholars, I had found, were often intellectually arrogant. The very greatest scholars were never so, and to this select band, Surendranath Das Gupta undoubtedly belonged. The lecture which Joe had arranged for me at Lucknow University was held in the philosophy department under the auspices of the University Philosophical Association, with Dr. Dasgupta himself in the chair. My subject was the Bodhisattva ideal. Thinking that the general intellectual level among university students would be much higher than that to which I was accustomed, I had not spoken at a university before, and not wishing to disappoint my audience by failing to do justice to the subject, I had prepared my talk quite carefully. After summarizing the standard esoteric presentation of the Bodhisattva ideal, I plunged into an exposition of the Bodhisattva's compassionate activity as the expression of his experience of shunyata, or voidness. As my text, so to speak, I took that well-known section of the Diamond Sutra in which the Bodhisattva is represented as vowing to lead countless sentient beings to nirvana, and yet, at the same time, realizing that there existed no sentient beings for him to lead to nirvana. When the meeting was over, I asked Dr. Dasgupta what the students and faculty members had made of the lecture. The old scholar smiled. He believed he was the only person present who had understood it, he said. It was after this experience that I began to doubt whether the intellectual level among university students, even those who were students of philosophy, was quite so high as hitherto I had, in my ignorance, supposed it to be. My 4 days in Lucknow was soon over, and it was not without feelings of regret that, having reached the furthest point of my itinerary, I said goodbye to Joe and started on the long journey back to Kalimpong. On the way, I halted in Calcutta, where I spent a few days looking up old friends. This pleasant duty accomplished, I made the journey from Calcutta to Siliguri by the longer route, which involved crossing the River Ganges by paddle steamer and catching another train on the other side. On the 5th of December, more than 24 hours after I had left Calcutta, the Land Rover in which I had travelled up from Siliguri deposited me at the foot of the well-known acclivity that led from the main road up to the Dharmodaya Vihara. I was back at last, back in Kalimpong, back in the hills, back facing Mount Kanchenjunga. My joy knew no bounds. I had been away for 2 weeks. During those 2 weeks, much had happened. Above all, the dearest wish of my heart had been granted. I had received the higher ordination. I had left Kalimpong a Sramanera, and now returned to it a bhikkhu, a full monk, a member of the monastic order established by the Buddha. Even though the Nyuas did not look after me, I was in a better position than ever to work for the good of Buddhism. At the top of the acclivity, a shock awaited me. All was not well at the Dharmodaya Vihara. All was not well with the YMBA. Taking advantage of my absence, Aniruddha had closed the recreation hut, nailing wooden boards across the door to prevent anyone getting in. Students turning up at the Vihara were told that all YMBA activities had been shut down, that the place did not belong to them, and that they were not wanted there. As for the English monk, who had had the effrontery to encourage low-caste people to use the place, he would be thrown out as soon as he arrived. True to his word, Aniruddha had not only moved into my old room, but had hurled my few belongings downstairs into the back hall. Swale, visiting the place a few days later, found my books and papers and a spare robe or two still lying scattered about on the floor. Gathering them up, he kept them in the downstairs back room formerly occupied by Joe. In this room, I now installed myself. Before long, Aniruddha came banging on the door. If I wanted to stay at the Vihara, he bawled, I would have to pay him 100 rupees a month's rent. Otherwise, I could clear out. End of chapter 6.